All right, good evening, everyone. If you have your Bibles, you might be turning to the book of Leviticus. We are in the midst of our study in that great Old Testament book there. I'm sure if you've been reading ahead, you might be looking at some of the sections going, why are we looking at this stuff? It's gross. It's yucky. it gets kind of detailed in some areas, and we'll be talking a little bit about that today as we continue the theme of this particular section, which is clean and unclean. Before we start, I'm going to ask Ken Smith, if you would, to lead us in a word of prayer, please. Well, last week we began our study on this particular section of the book, which is dealing with things that are clean and unclean. I had a little different outline last week. I kind of looked at it and went, I've got some more room on that slide. So I broke it out just a little bit more into some hopefully sections that will be easy for us to cover in hunks. But the first one, it starts out with the dietary restrictions. And we talked about that some last week, looking at those things that were pretty clear, you know, when they were talking about animals and being able to distinguish between things that had the split hooves and chewing the cud, pretty clear rules there. Things in the water. Anybody remember what the rule was, what they could eat? Fins and scales, okay? Got fins and scales, you can eat it. Now, what's interesting about that is, does that really distinguish somehow in the fish that are really good to eat and really bad to eat? Was that the point? And it wasn't, right? He was simply making a distinction. And one of the things that I want us to understand as we go through this is there are some principles that God was trying to get across to his people. And then there were the rules that he put in place so that they would understand those principles. Now, what do I mean by that? What do you think is one of the guiding principles here in this section? And we'll talk about more as we see it in these sections as we go along. What would you think of when you're saying, what is a principle that God's trying to teach his people here? Okay, obedience, certainly. I mean, he's laying down some rules, and he's expecting that they're going to follow them. Okay, he's making a distinction here, right? He's drawing some lines, and he's saying, I want you to follow in this way, and in this way, we are going to differentiate. And he uses a couple of different comparisons when he says, I want to be able to distinguish, like the title says, between what is clean and what is not clean, between what is holy what is not holy. We're going to create this distinction. And he comes out with saying, why are we doing this? And I think it's the theme of the book of Leviticus. If you go back, and that's why I put it on the slide there. Theme is what? Be holy, for I am holy. You need to be like God. That's what you're striving to be. Now, it's kind of interesting, and we're going to see this as we go through. As you look at goals, is that a worthy goal? Absolutely. Goals are kind of different things, though, aren't they? There are some things that you set as goals, and you work towards it, and you can achieve it, and you get there. And have you ever really worked hard for something, and then once you achieved it, you kind of went, okay, now what? You know, was it worth the effort and the trouble? I thought that quite often while I was working on my doctorate. There were many times when, you know, I was ready to go, I'm done. And my wife would go, no, you're not. You've put in too many hours so far. And then we got there, and okay, it was worth it, and I would do it again. If given the same circumstances, would I start another one? Not even close, not at this point, right? But it was a goal, and we worked to achieve it, and then we get there. But are there some goals you're never going to get to, but they're still worth working towards? You see, that's the kind of goals that God is setting up for his people. And he set that up under the old law with a whole bunch of laws and restrictions and things like that that we're going to be looking at. And those are the details of that. They were part of this old law. We're not under that now, right? We don't have these same restrictions. But does that mean that he doesn't have the same principle in mind when he says, be holy, for I am holy? It's just how we get there is a little different, isn't it? And he's still got rules and regulations for us. So when we look at a book like Leviticus, we need to be able to make those kinds of distinctions between what are the principles that God was trying to teach his people and what were the specific laws and regulations that don't apply to us now.
Are you saying that holy and unholy is synonymous with clean and unclean?
He makes those distinctions. They're not always synonymous, but they are a distinction. He's wanting you to be able to make a contrast. It doesn't necessarily mean that they all are parallel. So, for example, a person could be unclean, and we'll see some of that in just a minute with some of the things that happen. That did not equate to unholy, sinful. Now, if a person was unclean and they went into the presence of God in the tabernacle, that was a problem, right? Because he says, you can't come before me if you're unclean. So, no, they weren't parallel, but they were still the kinds of distinctions that he was wanting people to be able to say, oh, I can tell when something's clean versus unclean. I know how to make that distinction. I can tell when something's holy versus unholy. Does that make sense? So he's trying to make those, and he's going to have these contrasts. So as we go through this, we looked at a lot of the other dietary restrictions and things last week. I want to pick up with some kind of interesting things, because he talked about all the birds, and we noted the difficulties we had there in terms of the differences, because he listed a whole bunch of things that were, don't eat these, and then he had that really hard word at the end of it, which we don't like, because it makes us think, right? And it's like, and ones like this. Like, all right, what does that mean? Well, what that means is you got to do some diligence. You got to think about it. You got to work on it and try to decide what was going to be clean and unclean. Were there specific birds they knew were clean? Yeah. And so somebody might say, well, you know what? If I can't tell, I'm just going to stick with those. Would that have been okay? Absolutely. So there's times like that when you start looking to how are you going to conform to God's law? And when he gets there, he says, now, we've gone through all of this, and beginning down in verse 24, he starts talking about some things that might make you unclean. He says, you'll be made unclean whoever touches their carcasses, and whoever picks up any of their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. So, dead animal, dead critters, dead things. Do they have to be cleaned up? You got to clean them up. Okay, that's part of your agricultural society. Things die. They have to be taken care of. But if you touched a dead animal, then you were ceremonially unclean. Was that a sin? No, he's not saying that. He's just saying that there's an association there. Why do you think, what's he kind of calling to mind here? And there's several things we're going to see that start making sense in this pattern that he's laying down for them. So what are they touching? They're touching dead things, right? What's associated with death? Sin is associated with death, right? But it's associated with what came into this world as a part of man's sin. What is God? If you're going to make two big distinctions, what is God responsible for? Life, right? And so the opposite of that is death. And so he's saying, I want you to be able to understand that. I'm all about life. And so if you touch these things, which you're going to have to do, then you're going to be unclean, and the way that you clean yourself or become clean again is to do what?
Wash.
First thing is wash, and then you wait until evening. Why evening? Beginning of a new day, right? Because they had the evening and the morning were the first day. So that was it. You washed, and thus Leviticus is where, you know, cleanliness is next to godliness comes from. Because you're going to find that lots of the cures for being unclean was to do what? It was to wash and wait until the evening. So it's not a sin, but he's laying down that you would understand this distinction between clean and unclean. Verse 29, these are the unclean among the swarming things which swarm on the earth, the mole, the mouse, and the great lizard in its kinds, and the gecko, and the crocodile, and the lizard, and the sand reptile, and he goes on and lists a whole bunch of other things. And if you come in contact with these things, once again, you're unclean. Down in Florida, we would have spent a lot of time unclean, right? Lizards just kind of ran all over the house. My father always, we had the green animals here, not the slimy-looking geckos they have here in Texas. We had the real pretty green things. And, you know, they're much nicer. And trick is they'll try to get you. They don't hurt. My dad would clip them onto his ears and wear them as earrings. The kids were always impressed with that. But you're going to come in contact with these, right? And so it's not like you can isolate yourself from the world. He's just saying, this is part of life. But when you do, understand the clean and the unclean. Anything that one of them falls, once dead, becomes unclean, including any wooden article or clothing or skin or a sack, article of which use is made. It shall be put in water and be unclean until evening, and then it becomes clean. So, you find that a mouse has run across your clothes. What are you supposed to do? Wash your clothes. That makes sense. I like that. So he's giving this in a lot of detail here, isn't he? I mean, he's covering all kinds of territory when he puts this. And notice in verse 33, he says, as for any earthenware vessel, into any one of them may fall, whatever is in it becomes unclean, and you shall break the vessel. Why is that? What does it mean by earthenware? It's pottery, right? And a lot of their pottery was what we call unglazed. What does that mean? It absorbs things, right? And so that property is such that getting stuff out of it's not all that easy, right? And so they broke it. Turns out they broke a lot of those things. One of the garbage dumps, you know, when they archaeologists love finding garbage dumps because it's all the stuff people threw away, and that gives you a really good picture of their lives. And we find lots and lots of broken vessels, you know, and sometimes they try to piece them back together. And quite often they find writing on them. Those are called ostraca. Need something to write on. I had to break this pot anyway, so now we're going to write on it. Okay, so we got an earthenware pot. But if you go on down, he starts talking about all kinds of other things. What do you do if it's wooden? Take a guess. You got to wash it. Okay, what about if it's a stone pot? You got to wash it. So once again, we're going through this and making sure that we're ceremonially clean before God, that we understand this distinction. Yeah, it turns out that's one of the criteria, and in fact, they found places where they knew that there were Jewish workshops where they were making stone pottery, and you find these little plugs and inserts in them. It's really kind of interesting when you start reading through that. The other thing, and archaeologically, there's two things you look for: the preponderance of stone vessels. But what's the other one? Anybody want to take a guess? Lack of pig bones, because pigs were one of the major food sources in that region. But in Jewish towns, of course, you wouldn't find them. So that was one way you could tell whether a settlement was primarily Jewish when they're digging up the archaeology. And a lot of that is based on what we're studying here now, right? I mean, so people have taken that into account when they're looking at these civilizations and the things that distinguish them. And so you can see even in that view now, thousands of years, you know, past when these people are long dead, we're able to look at these restrictions that were on them and map that onto those who were adherent to God's law, which I find really interesting, because that's what separated them from the world at the time, and it's still, even in antiquity, what separated them, and we're able to tell that they were distinct people trying to be part of God. Okay, so he goes on down, and there's lots of things there, but I want you to go on down to verse 43. He says, do not render yourselves detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm, and you shall not make yourselves unclean with them so that you become unclean, for I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the Lord. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. Okay, why did he say it twice there? Emphasis. He's like, I'm going to make a point here. Why have we been talking about all of this stuff? I want you to get the point. I am the God that brought you out of Egypt. Why is that important? Wasn't a golden calf, right? It wasn't the gods of Egypt. It wasn't the gods in the land that they were now dwelling or going to dwell when Leviticus was written. I'm the one who did this. You should remember the plagues. You should remember all of the things that went on. I'm the one that has the authority to put this in place. And it's really an appeal to God's authority, is it not? But he says, I am God, and I want you to be holy. I want you to be set apart. I want you to be sanctified. That's what God always wanted for his people, is to be set apart from the world. So, this is the law regarding the animal and the bird and every living thing that moves in the waters and everything that swarms on the earth, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten. Now, I found that wording kind of interesting. Between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten. Did that mean they were inedible? No. It just means God said, don't eat those. And I, for one, am very glad those restrictions have been lifted, because there's lots of those critters that I enjoy eating at this point in time. But for them, this was part of being set aside and being holy to God. Make a distinction. Once again, that principle, being able to determine. Now, when you look at it from our perspective, New Testament times, we've got different sets of rules and things like that. But isn't the ability to distinguish not only the true black and white ends of things that we know are right or wrong, but just every day to decide, am I going to do something? Am I going to go somewhere? How am I going to talk to someone? How do you make those distinctions? How do you make those decisions? Isn't a lot of it still based on, I need to be able to understand what God is acceptable to God and what isn't? Getting into this clean and unclean, holy and unholy kind of realm? I think a lot of it does. And a lot of it has to do with how we perceive what we do before God. So, he'd made that distinction here and spent a whole chapter on animals, but now he's going to go off into another interesting little piece here. Chapter 12 is pretty short. It's only 8 verses there. And you might have some questions about it, because when you look at it, it's the purification rituals for a mother after she bears a child. There's a couple of interesting things. 8 short verses, so it's easy to read. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, when a woman gives birth and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean for 7 days, as in the days of her menstruation she shall be unclean, and on the 8th day the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Then she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 33 days. She shall not touch any consecrated thing, nor enter the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed. But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean for 2 weeks, as in her menstruation, and she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 66 days. When the days of her purification are completed for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the doorway of the tent of meeting a 1-year-old lamb for a burnt offering, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering. Then he shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her, and she shall be cleansed from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, whether a male or a female. But if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons, the one for a burnt offering and the other for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her, and she will be clean. Now, when you look at that on the surface, people look at it and go, okay, is it like a sin to have a child then? I mean, it kind of sounds kind of weird here, doesn't it, a little bit? I mean, they're offering sin offerings, all that kind of stuff, and now we got this purification stuff. And what's this up with male children only have 7 days and 33 days and females with 14 and 66? Now, that's just base discrimination, isn't it? So how do we go with this? Yeah, well, that was part of it. So the 8th day is when they're going to be circumcised. So she's through the unclean period after the 7 days, but then there's this purification period that goes on, you know, after that. And this is one of those areas that's kind of interesting. There are some times when we start looking at some of the rules and regulations that God laid down for them, and we want to impose our modern thinking on them. And sometimes I think it's okay, and sometimes it's not. So, for example, they say, why couldn't they eat pigs? Well, pigs can have trichinosis, and, you know, that could have been a really bad thing for them back then, so health reasons. Like, nah, you barbecue it really good, and you're not going to have a problem with it. So I don't think it was a health reason in there. He just made a distinction, right? But it's interesting, the 8th day, there's some interesting stuff around that medically, right? What is it on the 8th day? Well, it turns out that their vitamin K levels and things like that are at their maximum. They've come through that point where they're not going to have a bleeding problem. Wow, okay, so God picked that time. How would he know to do that? He made us. He designed the whole thing. So, of course he knows about that, right? So that's no mystery. And when you look at verses like in the Psalms, where it talks about, you know, somebody turn over to Psalms 127 and read verses 3 through 5. 127 verses 3 through 5. And it should be real clear from these verses what the real thought on having children was and in the family. Who's got that for me? Go ahead, Seth. Okay, so what's the whole point of those verses? Children are a blessing, okay? And back then he said, blessed are those who have what? Have their quiver full of them, okay? Now, we have different size quivers, and so we put different number of arrows in them. That's fine. But he's saying children are a blessing from the Lord. So, and yet here, this looks kind of contradictory until you start thinking about the whole process of childbirth. It's a little on the messy side, isn't it? And I mean, I know a lot of the ladies have been through this. Some of the husbands, I was in the early days where they were just barely letting us, you know, go in with our wives when the children were being born. You know, I wasn't banished to the room to wait. On the other hand, the first doctor, when Aaron was born, was one of these, like, you stand way over here and don't you begin to even touch. You know, it's like, okay, you know, whatever. Yeah, it turns out it's a messy process, right? What's one of the main things that's kind of flowing all over? It's blood, right? And does that not also have religious significance under the old law? Even under the Noahic covenant, what is it about blood? Life is in the blood, okay? And so losing blood can be a dangerous situation. And in fact, you know what the leading cause of death during and postpartum after childbirth is? Continued bleeding, blood loss, okay? We don't see it as much these days, right? Because we've got doctors, we've got hospitals, we've got all kinds of ways of doing that. You got to remember, and I'm amazed, you know, my grandmother had all of her kids at home. And she was a teeny woman. And I think her smallest baby was like, what, 10 pounds, 8 ounces or something like that. And they went up to like 12. And like, okay, this is scary. And she survived all of them, but a lot of people didn't, right? A lot of people didn't. Why? Well, bleeding was one aspect of that. And so when you look at it, uncleanness was associated with blood loss and blood discharge. We're going to see that a little bit later in some more passages that he's talking about here in Leviticus. But that being one of the leading causes of death, there's that period there. Now, the normal bleeding period, postpartum bleeding period, not a doctor, but I looked it up on the web. You can find anything on Wikipedia, is 2 to 6 weeks. How long is 6 weeks? How many days? 42. However, what's 7 plus 33? 40. We can do the math. It's real easy. But 40 is an interesting number, isn't it? 7 is an interesting number, but so is 40. You ever heard of 40 other places in the Bible? 40 days and 40 nights it rained? In fact, there's a lot of questions that people ask you. Just start with 40, you know, if it has to do with a number. You know, like, how long was it between Jesus' death and his resurrection, his ascension? 40 days. How long did David reign? 40 years. How long did Saul reign? 40 years. Okay. We're going to see a pattern here, okay? How long was Moses on the mountain? 40 days and 40. How long was Jesus in the wilderness? 40 days and 40. Okay. There's some significance there. And we've talked about numbers and things. We were talking about the book of Revelation. 40 is 4 times 10. What was 10? 10 was a complete number, okay? If you had all your fingers and toes, you're 10. What was 4? 4 was the cosmic number. You talk about four corners of the earth. That's one way, the four winds that blow, right? So you take 4 times 10, it's the complete cosmic number. It's what's perfect there in the earth. It's what was needed for that. So it's 40 days. And I just think it's kind of interesting that the 40 days lines up really close with 42, which is kind of the maximum period where somebody would still fall within the bounds of a normal birth to have some bleeding afterwards. So why do we have 80? That's 2 times 40 for a female. I don't know. I was hoping somebody here would. And were they really, it could have been a society, females were less regarded than males at that time, and so it's doubling there. And yet, there was an equalizer here. Was there different sacrifices that were performed? At the end of that time, whichever it was the same offering that they would go before the Lord. And he's not trying to imply that having a child or a child birth was a sin. But there were just times when it was necessary to go before the Lord. We all sin. We all do things. This was just part of the purification, cleansing, making sure that things were right as we're starting this new child in the world, as that the mother has gone forward and offered her cleansing sacrifices. It's also an acceptance that she's passed these periods and that she's acceptable again in society. Yeah. So the leading causes of death, we talked about that, and also infection, which we'll get to in a little bit. But sacrifice was the same in either one. And then, of course, it said, if they're too poor, what do they offer? Two turtle doves. And there, you got to love that connection with Luke. What's the connection there? Yeah, when Mary came to offer this offering, which shows that his parents were trying to do what was right, that they were trying to follow this law, right? So he had devout parents. They were still trying to obey this, but they were a little on the poor side because they just offered the two turtle doves. Okay, so next chapter. Any questions on that? Okay, next chapter is really gross, okay? But to understand it, we got to get past a little bit of terminology. And one of the things, if you go reading through it, you'll see one word that crops up over and over and over again if you've been through the 13th chapter here, and that is the word leprosy. There's a little bit of a problem because we associate leprosy with a very specific Hansen's disease, right? Well, it turns out there's kind of a history there, and that's where, you know, even in the early days when I was reading through Leviticus and thinking Hansen's disease every time I saw leprosy, some of the descriptions didn't quite match. I mean, Hansen's disease is terrible, but some of the things that they're talking about didn't quite match up with that. And that's because in the Septuagint, there's a Hebrew word, I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but they transliterated it into, when they did the Septuagint translation, and it called it lepra, which in that day was any kind of infectious disease. Okay, so in some of the newer translations, like the Net Bible or the Lexham English Bible, you'll see that they don't use the word leprosy. They specifically state a diseased infection or an infectious skin disease. So we need to understand that when we're looking at this translation. He's talking about any kind of messy, open thing that if you were to see somebody with it, you would go, ew. You know, that's kind of my definition, right? And now we say, okay, what are they going to be doing here? Well, you know, the priest is going to be examining a lot of these people. Let's keep one other thing right. Was the priest acting as a physician? No. He didn't offer any kind of cure for this. It was triage. It was, we got to separate this person. Why? Yeah, because there was the possibility of contaminating the rest of the community, which really is kind of interesting because in our country, the rights of an individual often outweigh the good of the many, right? That's just kind of the way this country's built. We've been struggling with this in several areas recently. How about under Jewish law? I don't think that was the case, as we're going to see here. Because if it looked like it could infect the community, what happened? You got isolated. You got banished outside the camp. Now, it didn't have to be permanent, and that's why some you find that there are these circumstances where someone is cured, and it didn't have to be a miraculous cure. If they had an infection and their body was able to fight it off and they could demonstrate that I'm okay now, then they went through a ritual to come back into the society again. So we need to understand that as we start looking at this chapter and looking at the kinds of things that the priest would be considering as he's looking at it. Okay, so it gets kind of ugly, but let's just take a look at a few of them. There's seven different things that he's outlined here. Verses 2 through 8 really talk about lesions of the skin, all right? And if you look at verse 2, it kind of gives you this sense of what he's going to start doing. He says a man has the skin of his body, a swelling or a scab or a bright spot, and it becomes an infection on the skin of his body. He shall be brought to Aaron or the priest or to one of his sons, the priest. So, right off, who's responsible for making this decision? It's one of the priests, right? And so, could somebody else turn somebody in? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that would have been part of it. I see somebody who may not have wanted to, you know, go before the priest, and they go, no, no, no. The priest needs to take a look at this. Why the priest? Okay, they at least have some training, right? They got the book of Leviticus, and it's got some guidelines for them to go on. And I suspect that they would pass and hand down from one generation to the next some of that training as they go and see these things. You got to remember, they lived in a different time than we do, too. These things would have been more common. I mean, even just in a lot of us who are older in our lifetimes, things have changed a lot in terms of what people catch and suffer from. And so, priest has got the training, but also, if somebody's going to be banished, then it's got to be someone with authority that makes that declaration, right? So one of the things that you're going to see is that the priest served not only in a spiritual capacity, but also a civil capacity, did they not? What was, I mean, you understand the difference between the religious, spiritual, and the civil side of things, but in that day and age, they were the same. When you had a contention with your neighbor, you first took it to the elders. If the elders couldn't satisfy it, where'd you go? You went to the priests. Right? So, they're the ultimate authority on this. They have been given the authority. But especially in this particular case, what's the priest's job? Is his job just to be able to tell you, ooh, you got something nasty looking? What is he really trying to be responsible for? As we keep this in mind. Okay, the high priest is definitely the intercessor between God and man. As his responsibility towards his flock goes, what's he trying to do? He's trying to make sure that they are clean and that they stay clean. And so if there is a threat to the cleanliness of the congregation, what's his not only duty but responsibility? Take it out, right? Move it off to a side. Get it to where we're protecting the congregation. So keep that in mind as we read through this. What they're trying to do is protect the congregation. Now, did that mean when somebody's sick, when somebody's got an infection, when there's some nasty disease that has befallen them, that suddenly they're sinners and God doesn't care about them anymore? See, we have to understand the difference there. They were unclean, and they were not allowed to go before God in the tabernacle. But their responsibilities we have to infer in some other ways. So, for example, can you think of someone who was a godly man who, for as far as we know, most of his life was never able to offer a sacrifice in the temple of God? I'll give you a hint. We're talking about captivity. You think Daniel was ever able to offer a sacrifice, come before God with a sacrifice? Why? He lived in Babylon. They didn't have the temple. It had been destroyed. Does that mean he couldn't be pleasing to God? God held him responsible for what he could do, right? And what he's responsible for. So let's keep that in mind as he's talking about isolating these people. These people could have still prayed to their God. They could have still been conscious of their sins. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, was designed for the nation. And so we have to understand this cleanliness, this what could come before God? Those who were pure, those who were right. That was that distinction that they're making there. What did you offer to God when it talked about the sacrifices in the first seven chapters? What was one of the characteristics of the sacrifices? Unblemished. Okay? And those who would come before God, there were certain things that if you had defects, even if a man was a son of Aaron, but he was born with a physical defect of some sort, he could not serve as a priest. That didn't diminish his worth as a person or before God, but it just meant in that capacity, he could not serve. So we look at these, and he talks about all of these things, and I'm sure Christy would know lots more about what all of these mean than I do, but people have gone through and looked at them and said, oh, well, this is like, you know, this disease and that disease and whatever. They didn't need the names of them back then. They were just looking to find out, is this something that might be infectious and might infect other people? And they're to look at them. And he goes on and he says, if there's a white spot and it's deeper than the skin and the hair on it's not turned white, and the priest is to isolate him for 7 days. So he takes a look and he says, okay, priest, we're going to examine this. His role is not medical. It's preventative. It's isolating. It's keeping the congregation clean. And he says, I can look at it. And if it really looks bad, what can he do right away? He can say, okay, this person's unclean. Outside the camp they go. If he's not sure, okay, we're looking at this one, we're not sure yet, what do? Isolate that person for 7 days. Why 7 days? It's a good number, yeah. It's a good number. And a lot of things do begin to heal in that time. I had this crazy, stupid infection on my forehead a few weeks ago. And, you know, that's one of those where, thank goodness for antibiotics, or I would have been barred outside the camp here because, yeah, there was got to be some bad-looking things there. But once we got on the antibiotics and things like that, within the first 7 days, it was starting to heal. You could see some improvement. Took 3 more weeks before it was, you know, in decent shape. But that's the whole point. You give it some time. Priest looks at it again. If he still couldn't tell, what could he do again? Wait another 7 days, right? Now, let me just bring a couple things up here. Almost a sideline, but not quite. There are times when you're going to run up against things where you're not sure what the answer is. Just like these priests, we're going to be able to look at some things and not know what the answer is. Sometimes it's okay to just sit on it for a while and think about it. And you never know when just reading or studying or something might come across an answer to what you've been looking for. It isn't always necessary right at every second to make an absolute decision on something. Sometimes we do have to stew on things and wait on things and look at things, and that's all right. Never put off until tomorrow, which you can put off forever. But there are just times when we have to be careful with making rash decisions, right? The priest was in that mode. Do you think the priest wanted to just kick everybody out of the community of the believers? No. And so if there's a question, he's going to say, let's give it some time. We'll look at this. In the meantime, we're going to keep you isolated over here. But we're going to take our time and look at this. Now, when it became clear, if it's starting to get better, they would go through and they would wash and they would do some things to cleanse, and then off they would go and they would be back part of the community. If it didn't get better, if it got worse, then they're exiled from the community. Again, the protection was for the community, not necessarily that person. Okay, so beginning of verse 9, it talks about ulcerated things, priest is going to look at them, and it talks a lot about hair and what things look like. You can go through and read it. We don't have to go through all of the gory details here today in class. But one of the things that you'll see quite often is in verse 14, for example, whenever the raw flesh appears on him, he shall be unclean. They're looking for things that are open, that are, you know, oozing, that have bodily discharges and those kinds of things associated with them. So that becomes clear that that's infectious. It's, you know, one of the things when that people, even like in our emergency medical personnel they have to be careful with, right? Why do you think they wear gloves and you know, coverings and things? Because you can catch things from bodily fluids of another person, right? And so the priests are looking at this, and I don't know, maybe they're using a stick to poke it or something. I'm not sure about the fingers, or they're going to wash their hands, right? But the point is they don't want other people coming into contact with this. And so when he gives these descriptions, these are the things the priest would be going on. Then he talks about boils and some changes that could occur there. I had boils when I was a kid on some of my legs quite often. They're nasty things. Infected burns, lesions in hair or beard. Verse 29 is kind of interesting because when he says hair or beard, there's a little qualification there. We'll finish this one up real quickly. Now, if a man or a woman has an infection on the head or the beard. Now, why would you? It's kind of weird the way that's worded there, right? If a man or a woman has hair or beard. The point is if he'd have just said, if a person has hair or beard, then a woman could have said, that doesn't apply to me. I don't have a beard, right? No, he's making, if you've got any kind of thing in your hair, you know, dandruff, psoriasis, those kinds of things, if it was clear what it was and it was just flaking or whatever and it talks about it being white as snow, then okay, that's a condition, but it's not infectious. But if it's got lesions, if it's got things that look nasty on it, then those were the things that could possibly be infectious. Once again, they got to be isolated. They got to be go through them. They got to live alone. And look in verse 46. It says, he shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. In the next chapter, we're going to deal with the whole point of becoming clean. What they had to do, and one of the things that the priest would have to do is go outside the camp to that person. They weren't allowed to come back in, even if they thought they were cured. That it was the priest's role to go out there first. Again, that distinction. What's clean? What's unclean? You are to be holy, because I am holy. Okay, we'll pick up there next week.